This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Joyland by Stephen King. Read by Michael Kelly.
I had a car, but on most days in that fall of 1973, I walked to Joyland from Mrs. Shoplaw's beachside accommodations in the town of Heavens Bay. It seemed like the right thing to do. The only thing, actually. By early September, Heaven Beach was almost completely deserted, which suited my mood. That fall was the most beautiful of my life. Even 40 years later, I can say that. And I was never so unhappy. I can say that, too. People think first love is sweet, and never sweeter than when that first bond snaps. You've heard 1,000 pop and country songs that prove the point. Some fool got his heart broke. Yet that first broken heart is always the most painful, the slowest to mend, and leaves the most visible scar. What's so sweet about that? Through September and right into October, the North Carolina skies were clear and the air was warm even at 7 in the morning when I left my second floor apartment by the outside stairs. If I started with a light jacket on, I was wearing it tied around my waist before I had finished half of the 3 miles between the town and the amusement park. I'd make Betty's Bakery my first stop, grabbing a couple of still warm croissants. My shadow would walk with me on the sand at least 20 feet long. Hopeful gulls smelling the croissants in their wax paper would circle overhead, and when I walked back, usually around 5, although sometimes I stayed later, there was nothing waiting for me in Heaven's Bay, a town that mostly went sleepy by when summer was over, my shadow walked with me on the water. If the tide was in, it would waver on the surface, seeming to do a slow hula. Although I can't be completely sure, I think the boy and the woman and their dog were there from the first time I took that walk. The shore between the town and the cheerful, blinking gimcrackery of Joyland was lined with summer homes, many of them expensive, most of them clapped shut after Labor Day, but not the biggest of them, the one that looked like a green wooden castle. A boardwalk led from its wide back patio down to where the seagrass gave way to the fine white sand. At the end of the boardwalk was a picnic table, shaded by a bright green beach umbrella. In its shade, the boy sat in his wheelchair, wearing a baseball cap and covered from the waist down by a blanket even in the late afternoons when the temperature lingered in the 70s. I thought he was 5 or so, surely no older than 7. The dog, a Jack Russell Terrier, either lay beside him or sat at his feet. The woman sat on one of the picnic table benches, sometimes reading a book, mostly just staring out at the water. She was very beautiful. Going or coming, I always waved at them, and the boy waved back. She didn't. Not at first. 1973 was the year of the OPEC oil embargo, the year Richard Nixon announced he was not a crook, the year Edward G. Robinson and Noel Coward died. It was Devin Jones's lost year. I was a 21-year-old virgin with literary aspirations. I possessed 3 pair of blue jeans, 4 pair of jockey shorts, a clunker Ford with a good radio, occasional suicidal ideations, and a broken heart. Sweet, huh? The heartbreaker was Wendy Keegan, and she didn't deserve me. It's taken me most of my life to come to that conclusion, but you know the old saw, better late than never. She was from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I was from South Berwick, Maine. That made her practically the girl next door. We had begun going together, as we used to say, during our freshman year at UNH. We actually met at the freshman mixer, and how sweet is that? Just like one of those pop songs. We were inseparable for 2 years, went everywhere together and did everything together. Everything, that is, but it. We were both work-study kids with university jobs. Hers was in the library, mine was in the Commons cafeteria. We were offered the chance to hold on to those jobs during the summer of 1972, and of course we did. The money wasn't great, but the togetherness was priceless. I assumed that would also be the deal during the summer of 1973, until Wendy announced that her friend Renee had gotten them jobs working at Filene's in Boston. "Where does that leave me?" I asked. "You can always come down," she said. "I'll miss you like mad, but really, Deb, we could probably use some time apart." A phrase that is very often a death knell. She may have seen that idea in my face because she stood on tiptoe and kissed me. "Absence makes the heart grow fonder," she said. "Besides, with my own place, maybe you can stay over." But she didn't quite look at me when she said that, and I never did stay over. "Too many roommates," she said, "too little time." Of course, such problems can be overcome, but somehow we never did, which should have told me something. In retrospect, it tells me a lot. Several times we had been very close to it, but it just never quite happened. She always drew back, and I never pressed her. God help me, I was being gallant. I have wondered often since what would have changed for good or for ill if I had not been. What I know now is that gallant young men rarely get pussy. Put it on a sampler and hang it in your kitchen. The prospect of another summer mopping cafeteria floors and loading elderly commons dishwashers with dirty plates didn't hold much charm for me. Not with Windy 70 miles south enjoying the bright lights of Boston. But it was steady work, which I needed, and I didn't have any other prospects. Then in late February, one literally came down the dish line to me on the conveyor belt. Someone had been reading Carolina Living while he or she snarfed up that day's blue plate luncheon special, which happened to be Mexicali burgers and caramba fries. He or she had left the magazine on the tray, and I picked it up along with the dishes. I almost tossed it in the trash, then didn't. Free reading material was, after all, free reading material. I was a work-study kid, remember? I stuck it in my back pocket and forgot about it until I got back to my dorm room. There it flopped onto the floor, open to the classified section at the back while I was changing my pants. Whoever had been reading the magazine had circled several job possibilities, although in the end, he or she must have decided none of them was quite right. Otherwise, Carolina Living wouldn't have come riding down the conveyor belt. Near the bottom of the page was an ad that caught my eye even though it hadn't been circled. In boldface type, the first line read, "Work close to heaven." What English major could read that and not hang in for the pitch? And what glum 21-year-old, beset with the growing fear that he might be losing his girlfriend, would not be attracted by the idea of working in a place called Joyland? There was a telephone number, and on a whim, I called it. A week later, a job application landed in my dormitory mailbox. The attached letter stated that if I wanted full-time summer employment, which I did, I'd be doing many different jobs, most but not all custodial. I would have to possess a valid driver's license, and I would need to interview. I could do that on the upcoming spring break instead of going home to Maine for the week. Only I'd been planning to spend at least some of that week with Wendy. We might even get around to it. "Go for the interview," Wendy said when I told her. She didn't even hesitate. "It'll be an adventure." "Being with you would be an adventure," I said. "There'll be plenty of time for that next year." She stood on tiptoe and kissed me. She always stood on tiptoe. Was she seeing the other guy even then? Probably not. But I'll bet she'd noticed him, because he was in an advanced sociology course. Renee St. Clair would have known and probably would have told me if I had asked. Telling stuff was Renee's specialty. I'll bet she wore the priest out when she did the old confession bit. But some things you don't want to know. Like why the girl you loved with all your heart kept saying no to you, but tumbled into bed with the new guy at almost the first opportunity. I'm not sure anybody ever gets completely over their first love, and that still rankles. Part of me still wants to know what was wrong with me. What I was lacking. I'm in my 60s now, my hair is gray, and I'm a prostate cancer survivor. But I still want to know why I wasn't good enough for Wendy Keegan. I took a train called the Southerner from Boston to North Carolina, not much of an adventure but cheap, and a bus from Wilmington to Heavens Bay. My interview was with Fred Dean, who was, among many other functions, Joyland's employment officer. After 15 minutes of Q&A, plus a look at my driver's license and my Red Cross life-saving certificate, he handed me a plastic badge on a lanyard. It bore the word visitor, that day's date, and a cartoon picture of a grinning, blue-eyed German shepherd who bore a passing resemblance to the famous cartoon sleuth Scooby-Doo. "Take a walk around," Dean said. "Ride the Carolina Spin if you like. Most of the rides aren't up and running yet, but that one is. Tell Lane I said okay. What I gave you is a day pass, but I want you back here by," he looked at his watch, "let's say 1 o'clock. Tell me then if you want the job. I've got 5 spots left, but they're all basically the same, as happy helpers." Thank you, sir. He nodded, smiling. Don't know how you'll feel about this place, but it suits me fine. It's a little old and a little rickety, but I find that charming. I tried Disney for a while. Didn't like it. It's too... I don't know.
Too corporate? I ventured.
Exactly. Too corporate. Too buffed and shiny. So I came back to Joyland a few years ago. Haven't regretted it. We fly a bit more by the seat of our pants here. Place has a little of the old-time carny flavor. Go on. Look around. See what you think. More important, see how you feel.
Can I ask one question first?
Of course.
I fingered my day pass. Who's the dog?
His smile became a grin. That's Howie the Happy Hound, Joyland's mascot. Bradley Easterbrook built Joyland, and the original Howie was his dog. Long dead now, but you still see a lot of him if you work here this summer.
I did, and I didn't. An easy riddle, but the explanation will have to wait a while. Joyland was an indie. Not as big as a Six Flags park and nowhere near as big as Disney World, but it was large enough to be impressive, especially with Joyland Avenue, the main drag, and Hound Dog Way, the secondary drag, almost empty and looking 8 lanes wide. I heard the whine of power saws and saw plenty of workmen, the largest crew swarming over the Thunderball, one of Joyland's 2 coasters. But there were no customers, because the park didn't open until May 15th. A few of the food concessions were doing business to take care of the workers' lunch needs, though, and an old lady in front of a star-studded Tell Your Fortune kiosk was staring at me suspiciously. With one exception, everything else was shut up tight. The exception of the Carolina Spin. It was 170 feet tall, this I found out later, and turning very slowly. Out in front stood a tightly muscled guy in faded jeans, balding suede boots splotched with grease, and a strap-style t-shirt. He wore a derby hat tilted on his coal-black hair. A filterless cigarette was parked behind one ear. He looked like a cartoon carnival barker from an old-time newspaper strip. There was an open toolbox and a big portable radio on an orange crate beside him. The faces were singing Stay With Me. The guy was bopping to the beat, hands in his back pockets, hips moving side to side. I had a thought, absurd but perfectly clear. When I grow up, I want to look just like this guy. He pointed to the pass. Freddie Dean sent you, right? Told you everything else was closed, but you could take a ride on the big wheel?
Yes, sir.
A ride on the spin means you're in. He likes the chosen few to get the aerial view. You gonna take the job?
I think so.
He stuck out his hand. I'm Lane Hardy. Welcome aboard, kid.
I shook with him. Devin Jones.
Pleased to meet you. He started up the inclined walk leading to the gently turning ride, grabbed a long lever that looked like a stick shift and edged it back. The wheel came to a slow stop with one of the gaily painted cabins, the image of Howie the Happy Hound on each, swaying at the passenger loading dock. Climb aboard, Jonesy. I'm going to send you up where the air is rare and the view is much more than fair.
I climbed into the cabin and closed the door. Lane gave it a shake to make sure it was latched, dropped the safety bar, then returned to his rudimentary controls.
Ready for takeoff, Captain?
I guess so.
Amazement awaits.
He gave me a wink and advanced the control stick. The wheel began to turn again, and all at once he was looking up at me. So was the old lady by the fortune-telling booth. Her neck was craned and she was shading her eyes. I waved to her. She didn't wave back. Then I was above everything but the convoluted dips and twists of the Thunderball, rising into the chilly early spring air and feeling, stupid but true, that I was leaving all my cares and worries down below. Joyland wasn't a theme park, which allowed it to have a little bit of everything. There was a secondary roller coaster called the Delirium Shaker, and a water slide, Captain Nemo's Splash and Crash. On the far western side of the park was a special annex for the little ones called the Wiggle Waggle Village. There was also a concert hall where most of the acts, this I also learned later, were either B-list C&W or the kind of rockers who peaked in the 50s or 60s. I remember that Johnny Otis and Big Joe Turner did a show there together. I had to ask Brenda Rafferty, the head accountant, who was also a kind of den mother to the Hollywood girls, who they were. Bren thought I was dense. I thought she was old. We were both probably right. Lane Hardy took me all the way to the top and then stopped the wheel.
I sat in the swaying car, gripping the safety bar, and looking out at a brand new world. To the west was the North Carolina flatland, looking incredibly green to a New England kid who was used to thinking of March as nothing but true spring's cold and muddy precursor. To the east was the ocean, a deep metallic blue until it broke in creamy white pulses on the beach where I would tote my abused heart up and down a few months hence. Directly below me was the good-natured jumble of Joyland, the big rides and small ones, the concert hall and concessions, the souvenir shops and the Happy Hound shuttle, which took customers to the adjacent motels and, of course, the beach. To the north was Heaven's Bay. From high above the park, upstairs where the air is rare, the town looked like a nestle of children's blocks from which four church steeples rose at the major points of the compass. The wheel began to move again. I came down feeling like a kid in a Rudyard Kipling story riding on the nose of an elephant. Lane Hardy brought me to a stop, but didn't bother to unlatch the car's door for me. I was, after all, almost an employee.
How'd you like it?
Great, I said.
Yeah, it ain't bad for a grandma ride.
He reset his derby so it slanted the other way and cast an appraising eye over me.
How tall are you? 6'3"?
6'4".
Uh-huh. Let's see how you like riding all 6'4" of you on the spin in the middle of July, wearing the fur and singing happy birthday to some spoiled rotten little snothole with cotton candy in one hand and melting collie cone in the other.
Wearing what fur? But he was headed back to his machinery and didn't answer. Maybe he couldn't hear me over his radio, which was now blasting Crocodile Rock. Or maybe he just wanted my future occupation as one of Joyland's cadre of happy hounds to come as a surprise. I had over an hour to kill before meeting with Fred Dean again, so I strolled up Hound Dog Way to a lunch wagon that looked like it was doing a pretty good business. Not everything at Joyland was canine-themed, but plenty of stuff was, including this particular eatery, which was called Pupalicious. I was on a ridiculously tight budget for this little job-hunting expedition, but I thought I could afford a couple bucks for a chili dog and a paper cup of French fries. When I reached the palm-reading concession, Madame Fortuna planted herself in my path. Except that's not quite right, because she was only Fortuna between May 15th and Labor Day. During those 16 weeks, she dressed in long skirts, gauzy layered blouses, and shawls decorated with various Kabbalistic symbols. Gold hoops hung from her ears so heavy they dragged the lobes down, and she talked in a thick Romany accent that made her sound like a character from a 1930s fright flick, the kind featuring misshrouded castles and howling wolves. During the rest of the year, she was a childless widow from Brooklyn who collected Hummel figures and liked movies, especially the weepy-ass kind where some chick gets cancer and dies beautifully. Today, she was smartly put together in a black pantsuit and low heels. A rose-pink scarf around her throat added a touch of color. As Fortuna, she sported masses of wild gray locks, but that was a wig and still stored under its own glass dome in her little Heaven's Bay house. Her actual hair was a cropped cap of dyed black. The love story fan from Brooklyn and Fortuna the Seer only came together in one respect. Both fancied themselves psychic.
"There is a shadow over you, young man," she announced.
I looked down and saw she was absolutely right. I was standing in the shadow of the Carolina Spin. We both were.
"Not that stupid, Nick. Over your future, you will have a hunger."
I had a bad one already, but a pupilicious foot long would soon take care of it. "That's very interesting, Mrs.,
Rosalind Gold," she said, holding out her hand. "But you can call me Rosie. Everyone does. But during the season..."
She fell into character, which meant she sounded like Bela Lugosi with breast.
"During the season, I am Fortuna."
I shook with her. If she had been in costume as well as in character, half a dozen gold bangles would have clattered on her wrist. "Very nice to meet you." And trying on the same accent,
"I am Devin."
She wasn't amused.
"An Irish name?"
"Right."
"The Irish are full of sorrow, and many have the sight. I don't know if you do, but you will meet someone who does."
Actually, I was full of happiness, along with that surpassing desire to put a pupilicious pup, preferably loaded with chili, down my throat. This was feeling like an adventure. I told myself I'd probably feel less that way when I was swabbing out toilets at the end of a busy day, or cleaning puke from the seats of the Whirly Cups. But just then, everything seemed perfect. "Are you practicing your act?" She drew herself up to her full height, which might have been 5'2".
"Is no act, my lad," she said act for act. "Jews are the most psychically sensitive race on earth. This is a thing everyone knows."
She dropped the accent. "Also, Joyland beats hanging out a palmistry shingle on 2nd Avenue. Sorrowful or not, I like you. You give off good vibrations."
"One of my very favorite Beach Boys songs."
"But you are on the edge of great sorrow," she paused, doing the old emphasis thing, "and perhaps danger."
"Do you see a beautiful woman with dark hair in my future?" Wendy was a beautiful woman with dark hair.
"No," Rosie said, and what came next stopped me dead. "She is in your past."
"Okay." I walked around her in the direction of Pupalicious, being careful not to touch her. She was a charlatan. I didn't have a single doubt about that, but touching her just then still seemed like a lousy idea. "No good," she walked with me.
"In your future is a little girl and a little boy. The boy has a dog."
"A happy hound, I bet. Probably named Howie." She ignored this latest attempt at levity.
"The girl wears a red hat and carries a doll. One of these children has the sight. I don't know which. It is hidden from me."
I hardly heard that part of her spiel. I was thinking of the previous pronouncement, made in a flat Brooklyn accent.
"She is in your past."
Madame Fortuna got a lot of stuff wrong, I found out. But she did seem to have a genuine psychic touch. And on the day I interviewed for a summer at Joyland, she was hitting on all cylinders. I got the job. Mr. Dean was especially pleased by my Red Cross life-saving certificate obtained at the YMCA the summer I turned 16. That was what I called my boredom summer. In the years since, I've discovered there's a lot to be said for boredom. I told Mr. Dean when my finals ended, and promised him that I'd be at Joyland 2 days later, ready for team assignment and training. We shook hands, and he welcomed me aboard. I had a moment when I wondered if he was going to encourage me to do the happy hound bark with him or something equivalent, but he just wished me a good day and walked out of the office with me, a little man with sharp eyes and a lithe stride. Standing on the little cement block porch of the employment office, listening to the pound of the surf and smelling the damp salt air, I felt excited all over again and hungry for summer to begin.
"You're in the amusement business now, young Mr. Jones," my new boss said. "Not the carny business. Not exactly, not the way we run things today, but not so far removed from it either. Do you know what that means, to be in the amusement business?"
"No, sir, not exactly."
His eyes were solemn, but there was a ghost of a grin on his mouth. "It means the rubes have to leave with smiles on their faces. And by the way, if I ever hear you call the customers rubes, you're going to be out the door so fast you won't know what hit you." "I can say it because I've been in the amusement business since I was old enough to shave. They're rubes. No different from the redneck Okies and Arkies that rubberneck their way through every carny I worked for after World War II. The people who come to Joyland may wear better clothes and drive Fords and Volkswagen microbuses instead of farm-all pickups, but the place turns them into rubes with their mouths hung open. If it doesn't, it's not doing its job. But to you, they're the conies. When they hear it, they think Coney Island. We know better. They're rabbits, Mr. Jones. Nice, plump, fun-loving rabbits hopping from ride to ride and shy to shy instead of from hole to hole."
He dropped me a wink and gave my shoulder a squeeze.
"The conies have to leave happy or this place dries up and blows away. I've seen it happen, and when it does, it happens fast. It's an amusement park, young Mr. Jones, so pet the conies and give their ears only the gentlest of tugs. In a word, amuse them."
"Okay," I said, although I didn't know how much customer amusement I'd be providing by polishing the devil wagons, Joyland's version of Dodge'em cars, or running a street sweeper down Hound Dog Way after the gates closed.
"And don't you dare leave me in the lurch. Be here on the agreed-upon date and 5 minutes before the agreed-upon time."
"Okay."
"There are two important showbiz rules, kiddo. Always know where your wallet is, and show up."
When I walked out beneath the big arch with Welcome to Joyland written on it in neon letters, now off, and into the mostly empty parking lot, Lane Hardy was leaning against one of the shuttered ticket booths, smoking the cigarette previously parked behind his ear.
"Can't smoke on the grounds anymore," he said.
New rule. Mr. Easterbrook says we're the first park in America to have it, but we won't be the last. Get the job?
I did.
Congratulations. Did Freddy give you the carny spiel?
Sorta, yeah.
Tell you about petting the conies?
Yeah.
He can be a pain in the banana, but he's old-time showbiz, seen it all, most of it twice, and he's not wrong. I think you'll do okay. You got a carny look about you, kid.
He waved a hand at the park with its landmarks rising against the blameless blue sky, the Thunderball, the Delirium Shaker, the convoluted twists and turns of Captain Nemo's water slide, and of course, the Carolina Spin.
Who knows? This place might be your future.
Maybe, I said, although I already knew what my future was going to be, writing novels and the kind of short stories they publish in the New Yorker. I had it all planned out. Of course, I also had marriage to Wendy Keegan all planned out, and how we'd wait until we were in our 30s to have a couple of kids. When you're 21, life is a roadmap. It's only when you get to be 25 or so that you begin to suspect that you've been looking at the map upside down, and not until you're 40 are you entirely sure. By the time you're 60, take it from me, you're fucking lost.
Did Rosie Gold give your usual bundle of Fortuna horse shit?
Lane chuckled.
Why do I even ask? Just remember, kid, the 90% of everything she says really is horse shit. The other 10, let's just say she's told folks some stuff that rocked them back on their heels.
What about you? I asked. Any revelations that rocked you back on your heels? He grinned.
The day I let Rosie read my palm is the day I go back on the road ride jockeying the Tornado and Chitlin circuit. Mrs. Hardy's boy doesn't mess with Ouija boards and crystal balls.
Do you see a beautiful woman with dark hair in my future? I'd asked.
No, she is in your past.
He was looking at me closely.
What's up? You swallow a fly?
It's nothing, I said.
Come on, son. Did she feed you truth or horseshit? Live or Memrex? Tell your daddy.
Definitely horseshit. I looked at my watch. I've got a bus to catch at 5. If I'm going to make the train to Boston at 7, I better get moving.
You got plenty of time. Where are you staying this summer?
I hadn't even thought about it.
You might want to stop at Mrs. Shoplaw's on the way to the bus station. Plenty of people in Heaven's Bay rent to summer help, but she's the best. She has a lot of happy helpers over the years. Her place is easy to find. It's where Main Street ends at the beach. Great big rambler, painted gray. You'll see the sign hanging from the porch. Can't miss it because it's made out of shells and some are always falling off. Mrs. Shoplaw's Beachside Accommodations. Tell her I sent you.
Okay, I will, thanks.
If you rent there, you can walk down here on the beach if you want to save gas money for something more important, like stepping out on your day off. That beach walk makes a pretty way to start the morning. Good luck, kid. Look forward to working with you.
He held out his hand. I shook it and thanked him again.
Since he'd put the idea in my head, I decided to take the beach walk back to town. It would save me 20 minutes waiting for a taxi I couldn't really afford.
I had almost reached the wooden stairs going down to the sand when he called after me.
Hey, Jonesy, want to know something Rosie won't tell you?
Sure, I said.
We got a spook palace called Horror House. The old Rosola won't go within 50 yards of it. She hates the pop-ups and the torture chamber and the recorded voices. But the real reason is that she's afraid that it really might be haunted.
Yeah?
Yeah. And she ain't the only one. Half a dozen folks who work here claim to have seen her.
Are you serious? But this was just one of the questions you ask when you're flabbergasted. I could see he was.
I'd tell you the story, but break time's over for me. I got some power poles to replace on the devil wagons, and the safety inspection guys are coming to look at the Thunderball around 3. What a pain in the ass those guys are. Ask Shoplaw. When it comes to Joyland, Emelina Shoplaw knows more than I do. You can say she's a student of the place. Compared to her, I'm a newbie.
This isn't a joke? A little rubber chicken you tossed all the new hires?
Do I look like I'm joking?
He didn't, but he did look like he was having a good time. He dropped me a wink.
What's a self-respecting amusement park without a ghost? Maybe you'll see her yourself. The rubes never do, that's for sure. Now hurry along, kiddo. Nail down a room before you catch the bus back to Wilmington. You'll thank me later.
With a name like Emelina Shoplaw, it's hard not to picture a rosy-cheeked landlady out of a Charles Dickens novel, one who went everywhere to bosom me bustle and said things like, "Lord save us." She'd served tea and scones while a supporting cast of kind-hearted eccentrics looked on approvingly. She might even pinch my cheek as we sat roasting chestnuts over a crackling fire. But we rarely get what we imagine in this world, and the gal who answered my ring was tall, 50-ish, flat-chested, and as pale as a frosted window pane. She carried an old-fashioned beanbag ashtray in one hand and a smoldering cigarette in the other. Her mousy brown hair had been done up in fat coils that covered her ears. They made her look like an aging version of a princess in a Grimm's fairy tale. I explained why I was there. "Going to work at Joyland, huh? Well, I guess you better come in. Do you have references?" "Not apartment references, no. I live in a dorm. But I've got a work reference from my boss at the Commons. The Commons is a food service cafeteria at UNH where I..." "I know what a Commons is. I was born at night, but it wasn't last night." She showed me into the front parlor. A house-long room stuffed with mismatched furniture and dominated by a big table model TV. She pointed at it. "Color. My renters are welcome to use it, and the parlor, until 10 on weeknights and midnight on the weekends. Sometimes I join the kids for a movie or the Saturday afternoon baseball. We have pizza or I make popcorn. It's jolly." Jolly, I thought, as in jolly good, and it sounded jolly good. "Tell me, Mr. Jones, do you drink and get noisy? I consider that sort of behavior antisocial, although many don't." "No, ma'am. I drank a little, but rarely got noisy. Usually after a beer or two, I just got sleepy." "Asking if you use drugs would be pointless. You'd say no whether you do or don't, wouldn't you? But of course that sort of thing always reveals itself in time, and when it does, I invite my renters to find fresh accommos. Not even pot. Are we clear on that?" "Yes." She peered at me. "You don't look like a pothead." "I'm not." "I have space for 4 boarders, and only one of those places is currently taken, Miss Ackerley. She's a librarian. All my rents are single rooms, but they're far nicer than what you'd find in a motel. The one I'm thinking of for you is on the 2nd floor. It has its own bathroom and shower, which those on the 3rd floor do not. There's an outside staircase, too, which is convenient if you have a lady friend. I have nothing against lady friends, being both a lady and quite friendly myself. Do you have a lady friend, Mr. Jones?" "Yes, but she's working in Boston this summer." "Well, perhaps you will meet someone. You know what the song says, love is all around." I only smiled at that. In the spring of 73, the concept of loving anyone other than Wendy Keegan seemed utterly foreign to me. "You'll have a car, I imagine. There are just 2 parking spaces out back for 4 tenants, so every summer it's first come, first served. You're first come, and I think you'll do. If I find you don't, it's down the road you'll go. Does that strike you as fair?" "Yes, ma'am." "Good, because that's the way it is. I'll need the usual. First month, last month, damage deposit." She named a figure that also seemed fair. Nevertheless, it was going to make a shambles of my first New Hampshire trust account. "Will you take a check? Will it bounce?" "No, ma'am, not quite." She threw back her head and laughed. "Then I'll take it, assuming you still want the room once you've seen it." She stubbed out her cigarette and rose. "By the way, no smoking upstairs. It's a matter of insurance. And no smoking in here once the tenants are in residence. That's a matter of common politeness." "Do you know that old man Easterbrook is instituting a no-smoking policy at the park?" "I heard that. He'll probably lose business." "He might at first. Then he might gain some. I'd put my money on Brad. He's a shrewd guy, Carney from Carney." I thought to ask her what that meant exactly, but she had already moved on. "Shall we have a peek at the room?" A peek at the 2nd floor room was enough to convince me it would be fine. The bed was big, which was good, and the window looked out on the ocean, which was even better. The bathroom was something of a joke, so tiny that when I sat on the commode, my feet would be in the shower. But college students with only crumbs in their financial cupboards can't be too picky. And the view was the clincher. I doubted if the rich folks had a better one from their summer places along Heaven's Row. I pictured bringing Wendy here, the two of us admiring the view, and then, in the big bed with the steady, sleepy beat of the surf outside, it. Finally, it. "I want it," I said, and I felt my cheeks heat up. It wasn't just the room I was talking about. "I know you do. It's all over your darn face." As if she knew what I was thinking, and maybe she did. She grinned, a big wide one that made her almost Dickensian in spite of her flat bosom and pale skin. Your own little nest. Not the Palace of Versailles, but your own. Not like having a dorm room, is it? Even a single. No, I admitted. I was thinking I'd have to talk my dad into putting another $500 into my bank account to keep me covered until I started getting paychecks. He'd grouse, but come through. I just hoped I wouldn't have to play the dead mom card. She had been gone almost 4 years, but Dad carried half a dozen pictures of her in his wallet and still wore his wedding ring. Your own job and your own place, she said, sounding a bit dreamy. That's good stuff, Devin. You mind me calling you Devin? Make it Dev. All right, I will. She looked around the little room with its sharply sloping roof it was under an eave, and sighed. The thrill doesn't last long, but while it does, it's a fine thing. That sense of independence. I think you'll fit in here. You've got a corny look about you. You're the second person to tell me that. Then I thought of my conversation with Lane Hardy in the parking lot. Third, actually. And I bet I know who the other two were. Anything else I can show you? The bathroom's not much, I know, but it beats having to take a dump in a dormitory bathroom while a couple of guys at the sinks fart and tell lies about all the girls they made out with last night. I burst into roars of laughter, and Mrs. Emelina Shoplaw joined me. We descended by way of the outside stairs. How's Lane Hardy? She asked when we got to the bottom. Still wearing that stupid beanie of his? It looked like a derby to me. She shrugged. Beanie, derby, what's the diff? He's fine, but he told me something. She was giving me a head-cocked look, almost smiling, but not quite. He told me the Joyland Funhouse, horror house, he called it, is haunted. I asked him if he was pulling my leg, and he said he wasn't. He said you knew about it. Did he now? Yes. He says that when it comes to Joyland, you know more than he does. Well, she said, reaching into the pocket of her slacks and bringing out a pack of Winston's. I know a fair amount. My husband was chief engineering down there until he took a heart attack and died. When it turned out his life insurance was lousy and barred against it the hilt in the bargain, I started renting out the top two stories of this place. What else was it going to do? We just had the one kid, and now she's up in New York working for an ad agency. She lit her cigarette, inhaled, and chuffed it back out as laughter. Working on losing her southern accent, too, but that's another story. This overgrown monstrosity of a house was Howie's play toy, and I never begrudged him. At least it's paid off, and I like staying connected to the park, because it makes me feel like I'm still connected to him. Can you understand that? Sure. She considered me through a rising raft of cigarette smoke, smiled, and shook her head. No, you're being kind, but you're a little too young. I lost my mom 4 years ago. My dad's still grieving. He says there's a reason wife and life sound almost the same. I've got school, at least, and my girlfriend. Dad's not going to run a house just north of Kittery that's way too big for him. He knows he should sell it and get a smaller one closer to where he works. We both know. But he stays. So, yeah, I know what you mean. I'm sorry for your loss, Mrs. Shoplaw said. Some hell open my mouth too wide and fall right in. That bus of yours, is it the 510? Yes. Well, come on in the kitchen. I'll make you a toasted cheese and microwave you a bowl of tomato soup. You got time. And I'll tell you the sad story of the Joyland ghost while you eat if you want to hear it. Is it really a ghost story? I've never been in that damn funhouse, so I don't know for sure. But it's a murder story. That much I am sure of. The soup was just Campbell's out of the can, but the toasted cheese was Munster, my favorite, and tasted heavenly. She poured me a glass of milk and insisted I drink it. I was, Mrs. Shoplaw said, a growing boy. She sat down opposite me with her own bowl of soup, but no sandwich. Have to watch my girlish figure, and told me the tale. Some of it she had gotten from the newspapers and TV reports. The juicier bits came from her Joyland contacts, of whom she had many. It was 4 years ago, which I guess would make it around the same time your mother died. Do you know what always comes first to my mind when I think about it? The guy's shirt and the gloves. Thinking about those things gives me the creeps, because it means he planned it. You might be kind of starting in the middle, I said. Mrs. Shoplaw laughed. Yeah, I suppose I am. The name of your supposed ghost is Linda Gray, and she was from Florence. That's way over South Carolina way. She and her boyfriend, if that's what he was. The cops checked her background pretty closely and found no trace of him. Spent her last night on Earth in the Luna Inn, half a mile south of here along the beach. They entered Joyland around 11 o'clock the next day. He bought them day passes using cash. They rode some rides and then had a late lunch at Rock Lobster, the seafood place down by the concert hall. That was past 1 o'clock. As for the time of death, you probably know how they establish it, contents of the stomach and so on. Yeah. My sandwich was gone, and I turned my attention to the soup. The story wasn't hurting my appetite any. I was 21, remember? And although I would have told you different, deep down I was convinced I was never going to die. Not even my mother's death had been able to shake that core belief. He fed her, and then he took her on the Carolina Spin. A slow ride, you know, easy on the digestion. And then he took her into the horror house. They went in together, but only he came out. About halfway along the course of the ride, which takes about 9 minutes, he cut her throat and he threw her out beside the monorail track the cars run on. Threw her out like a piece of trash. He must have known there'd be a mess, because he was wearing 2 shirts, and he put on a pair of yellow work gloves. They found the top shirt, the one that would have caught most of the blood, about 100 yards further along from the body. The gloves a little further along still. I could see it. First the body, still warm and pulsing, then the shirt, then the gloves. The killer, meanwhile, sits tight and finishes the ride. Mrs. Shoplaw was right. It was creepy. When the ride ended, the son of a bee just got out and walked away. He mopped up the car. That shirt they found was sopping, but he didn't quite get all the blood. One of the helpers spotted some on the seat before the next ride started and cleaned it up. Didn't think twice about it, either. Blood on amusement park rides isn't unusual. Mostly it's some kid who gets overexcited and has a nose gusher. You'll find out for yourself. Just make sure you wear your own gloves when you do the cleanup in case of diseases. They have them at all the first aid stations, and there are first aid stations all over the park. Nobody noticed that he had got off the ride without his date? Nope. This was mid-July, the very height of the season, and the place was a swarming madhouse. They didn't find the body until 1 o'clock the next morning, long after the park was closed and the horror house work lights were turned on. For the graveyard shift, you know. You'll get a chance to experience that. All the happy helper crews get cleanup duty 1 week a month, and you want to catch up on your sleep ahead of time, because that swing shift's a booger. People rode past her until the park closed and didn't see her. If they did, they thought it was just part of the show, but probably the body went unnoticed. Remember, Horror House is a dark ride, the only one in Joyland as it happens. Other parks have more. A dark ride. I struck a shivery chord. But it wasn't strong enough to keep me from finishing my soup. What about a description of them? Maybe from whoever served them at the restaurant? They had better than that. They had pictures. You want to believe the police made sure they got on TV and printed in the newspapers. How did that happen? The Hollywood girls, Mrs. Shoplaw said. There are always half a dozen work in the park when it's going full blast. There's never been anything close to a cooch joint at Joyland, but old man Easterbrook didn't spend all these years in rolling carnies for nothing. He knows people like a little dash of sex appeal to go with the rides and the corn dogs. There's one Hollywood girl on each helper team. You'll get yours, and you and the rest of the guys on your team will be expected to keep your big brotherly eye out in case anyone bothers her. They run around in these short green dresses and green high heels and cutie pie green hats that always make me think of Robin Hood and his merry men. Only they're the merry chicks. They tote speed graphic cameras like the kind you see in old movies, and they take pictures of the rubes. She paused. Although I'd advise you against calling the customers out yourself. Already been warned by Mr. Dean, I said. Figures. Anyhow, the Hollywood girls are told to concentrate on family groups and dating couples who look over 21. Kids younger than that usually aren't interested in souvenir photos. They'd rather spend their money on food and arcade games. So the deal is, the girls snap first, then approach. She did a breathy little Marilyn Monroe voice.
Hello. Welcome to Joyland. I'm Karen. If you'd like a copy of the picture I just took, give me your name and check at the Hollywood photo booth in Hound Dog Way as you exit the park.
Like that. One of them took a picture of Linda Gray and her boyfriend at the Annie Oakley Shooting Gallery, but when she approached, the guy gave her the brush off. A hard brush off. She told the cops later that he looked like he would have taken her camera and broken it if he thought he could get away with it. said his eyes gave her chills. Hard and gray, she said. Mrs. Shoplaw smiled and shrugged. Only it turned out he was wearing sunglasses. You know how some girls like to dramatize. As a matter of fact, I did. Wendy's friend Renee could turn a routine trip to the dentist into a horror movie scenario. That was the best picture, but not the only one. The cops went through all the Hollywood girl snaps from that day and found the gray girl and her friend in the background of at least four others. In the best of those, they're standing in line for the Whirly Cups, and he's got his hand on her keister. Pretty chummy for someone none of her family or friends had ever seen before. Too bad there aren't closed-circuit TV cameras, I said. My lady friend got a job at Filene's in Boston this summer, and she says they got a few of those cameras and are putting up more to foil shoplifters. A day will come when they have them everywhere, she said. Just like in that science fiction book about the thought police. I don't look forward to it either. But they'll never have them in rides like Horror House. Not even infrared ones can see in the dark. No? Nope. There's no tunnel of love at Joyland, but Horror House is most definitely the tunnel of grope. My husband told me once that a day when the graveyard shift cleanup crew doesn't find at least three pair of panties besides its track is a slow day indeed. But they did have that one great photo of the guy at the shooting gallery. A portrait, almost. It ran in the papers and on TV for a week. Him snuggled up to her, hip to hip, showing her how to hold the rifle the way the guys always do. Everyone in both Carolinas must have seen it. She's smiling, but he looks dead serious. With his gloves and knife in his pockets the whole time, I said, marveling at the idea. Razor. Huh? He's a straight razor. Or something like it. That's what the medical examiner figured. Anyway, they had those photos, including the one great one, and you know what? You can't make his face out in any of them. Because of the sunglasses? For starters, also a goatee that covered his chin, and a baseball cap. The kind with a long bill that shaded what little of his face his sunglasses and goatee didn't cover. Could have been anyone. Could have been you, except for you're dark-haired instead of blonde and don't have a bird's head tattooed on one of your hands. This guy did. An eagle or maybe a hawk. It showed up very clearly in the shooting gallery pic. They ran a blow-up of the tat in the paper for 5 days running, hoping someone would recognize it. Nobody did. No leads at the inn where they stayed the night before? Uh-uh. He showed a South Carolina driver's license when he checked in, but it was stolen a year before. No one even saw her. She must have waited in the car. She was a Jane Doe for almost a week, but the police released a full face sketch. Made her look like she was sleeping, not dead with her throat cut. Someone, a friend she went to nursing school with, I think it was, saw it and recognized it. She told the girl's parents. I can't imagine how they must have felt, coming up here in their car and hoping against hope that when they got to the morgue it would turn out to be someone else's well-loved child. She shook her head slowly. Kids are such a risk, Dev. That ever cross your mind? I guess so. Which means it hasn't. Me, I think if they turned back that sheet and it was my daughter laying there, I'd lose my mind. You don't think Linda Gray really haunts the funhouse, do you? I can't answer that, because I hold no opinion on the afterlife, pro or con. My feeling is I'll find that stuff out when I get there, and that's good enough for me. All I know is that lots of people who work at Joyland claim to have seen her standing beside the track. Wearing what she had on when they found her. Blue skirt and blue sleeveless blouse. None of them would have seen those colors in the photos they released to the public, because the speed graphics the Hollywood girls use only shoot black and white. Easier and cheaper to develop, I guess. Maybe the color of her clothes was mentioned in the articles. She shrugged. Might have been. I don't remember. But several people have also mentioned that the girl they saw standing by the track was wearing a blue Alice band. And that wasn't in the news stories. They held it back for almost a year, hoping to use it on a likely suspect if they came up with one. Lane said the Rubes never see her. Nope, she only shows up after hours. It's mostly happy helpers on the graveyard shift who see her, but I know at least one safety inspector from Raleigh who claims he did, because I had a drink with him at the Sand Dollar. Guy said she was just standing there on his ride through. He thought it was a new pop-up until she raised her hands to him like this. Mrs. Shoplaw held her hands out with her palms upturned, a supplicatory gesture. He said it felt like the temperature dropped 20 degrees. A cold pocket, he called it. When he turned and looked back, she was gone. I thought of Lane in his tight jeans, scuffed boots, and tilted tough boy derby. "Truth or horseshit?" he'd asked. "Live or Memorex?" I thought the ghost of Linda Gray was almost certainly horseshit. But I hoped it wasn't. I hoped I would see her. It would be a great story to tell Wendy, and in those days, all my thoughts led back to her. If I bought this shirt, would Wendy like it? If I wrote a story about a young girl getting her first kiss while on a horseback ride, would Wendy enjoy it? If I saw a ghost of a murdered girl, would Wendy be fascinated? Maybe enough to want to come down to see for herself? There was a follow-up story in the Charleston Post-Courier about 6 months after the murder, Mrs. Shoplaw said. Turns out that since 1961, there have been 4 similar murders in Georgia and the Carolinas. All young girls. One stabbed, 3 others with their throats cut. The reporter dug up at least one cop who said all of them could have been killed by the guy who murdered Linda Gray.
"Beware the funhouse killer," I said in a deep announcer-type voice.
That's exactly what the paper called him. "Hungry, weren't you? You ate everything but the bowl. Now I think you better write me that check and beat feet on the bus station, or you're apt to be spending the night on my sofa." Which looked comfortable enough, but I was anxious to get back north. 2 days left in spring break, and then I'd be back at school with my arm around Wendy Keegan's waist. I took out my checkbook, scribbled, and by doing so rented a one-room apartment with a charming ocean view that Wendy Keegan, my lady friend, never got a chance to sample. That room was where I sat up some nights with my stereo turned down low playing Jimi Hendrix and the Doors, having those occasional thoughts of suicide. They were sophomoric rather than serious, just the fantasies of an overimaginative young man with a heart condition, or so I tell myself now all these years later. But who really knows? When it comes to the past, everyone writes fiction. I tried to reach Wendy from the bus station, but her stepmom said she was out with Renee. When the bus got to Wilmington, I tried again, but she was still out with Renee. I asked Nadine, the stepmom, if she had any idea where they might have gone. Nadine said she didn't. She sounded as if I were the most uninteresting caller she had gotten all day. Maybe all year. Maybe in her life. I got along well enough with Wendy's dad, but Nadine Keegan was never one of my biggest fans. Finally, I was in Boston by then. I got Wendy. She sounded sleepy. Although it was only 11 o'clock, which is the shank of the evening to most college students on spring break, I told her I got the job.
"Hooray for you," she said. "Are you on your way home?"
"Yes, as soon as I get my car, and if it didn't have a flat tire. In those days, I was always running on baldies, and it seemed one of them was always going flat." "A spare, you ask? Pretty funny, senor. I could spend the night in Portsmouth instead of going straight home and see you tomorrow if..."
"Wouldn't be a good idea. Renee's staying over, and that's about all the company Nadine can take. You know how sensitive she is about company."
Some company, maybe. But I thought Nadine and Renee had always gotten on like a house afire, drinking endless cups of coffee and gossiping about their favorite movie stars as if they were personal friends. But this didn't seem like the time to say so.
"Ordinarily, I'd love to talk to you, Dev, but I was getting ready to turn in. Me and Ren had a busy day, shopping and things."
She didn't elaborate on the things part, and I found I didn't care to ask about them. Another warning sign. "Love you, Wendy."
"Love you, too."
That sounded perfunctory rather than fervent. "She's just tired," I told myself. I rolled north out of Boston with a distinct feeling of unease. Something about the way she had sounded. The lack of enthusiasm. I don't know. I wasn't sure I wanted to know. But I wondered. Sometimes even now, all these years later, I wonder. She's nothing to me these days but a scar and a memory. Someone who hurt me as young women will hurt young men from time to time. A young woman from another life. Still, I can't help wondering where she was that day. What those things were. And if it was really Renee Sinclair she was with. We could argue about what constitutes the creepiest line in pop music, but for me, it's early Beatles. John Lennon, actually, singing, "I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man." I could tell you I never felt that way about Wendy in the aftermath of the breakup, but it would be a lie. It was never a constant thing. But did I think of her with a certain malevolence in the aftermath of the breakup? Yes. There were long and sleepless nights when I thought she deserved something bad, maybe really bad, to happen to her for the way she hurt me. It just made me to think that way. But sometimes I did. And then I would think about the man who went into Horror House with his arm around Linda Gray and wearing 2 shirts. the man with the bird on his hand and a straight razor in his pocket. In the spring of 1973, the last year of my childhood when I look back on it, I saw a future in which Wendy Keegan was Wendy Jones, or perhaps Wendy Keegan Jones if she wanted to be more modern and keep her maiden name in the mix. There would be a house on a lake in Maine or New Hampshire, maybe western Massachusetts, filled with the clatter and yell of a couple of little Keegan Joneses. A house where I wrote books that weren't exactly bestsellers, but popular enough to keep us comfortably and were very important, well-reviewed. Wendy would pursue her dream of opening a small clothing boutique, also well-reviewed, and I would teach a few creative writing seminars, the kind gifted students vie to get into. None of this ever happened, of course, so it was fitting that the last time we were together as a couple was in the office of Professor George B. Nako, a man who never was. In the fall of 1968, returning University of New Hampshire students discovered Professor Nako's office under the stairs in the basement of Hamilton Smith Hall. The space was papered with fake diplomas, peculiar watercolors labeled Albanian art, and seating plans with such names as Elizabeth Taylor, Robert Zimmerman, and Lyndon Baines Johnson penciled into the squares. There were also posted themes from students who never existed. One I remember was titled Sex Stars of the Orient. Another was called The Early Poetry of Cthulhu, an Analysis. There were three standing ashtrays. A sign taped to the underside of the stairs read, Professor Nako says the smoking lamp is always lit. There were a couple of ratty easy chairs and an equally ratty sofa, very handy for students in search of a comfy makeout spot. The Wednesday before my last final was unseasonably hot and humid. Around 1 in the afternoon, thunderheads began to build up, and around 4, when Winnie had agreed to meet me in George B. Nako's underground office, the skies opened and it began to pour. I got there first. Wendy showed up 5 minutes later, soaked to the skin, but in high good humor. Droplets of water sparkled in her hair. She threw herself into my arms and wriggled against me, laughing. Thunder boomed. The few hanging lights in the gloomy basement hallway flickered.
Hug me, hug me, hug me, she said. That rain is so cold.
I warmed her up, and she warmed me up. Pretty soon we were tangled together on the ratty sofa. My left hand curled around her and cupping her braless breast, my right far enough up her skirt to brush against silk and lace. She let that one stay there for a minute or two, then sat up, moved away from me, and fluffed her hair.
Enough of that,
she said primly.
What if Professor Nako came in?
I don't think that's likely to you. I was smiling, but below the belt I was feeling a familiar throb. Sometimes Wendy would relieve that throb. She had become quite expert at what we used to call a through-the-pants job, but I didn't think this was going to be one of those days.
One of his students, then, she said, begging for a last-chance passing grade. Please, Professor Nako, please, 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 I'll do anything.
That wasn't likely either, but the chances of being interrupted were good. She was right about that. Students were always dropping by to put up new bogus themes or fresh works of Albanian art. The sofa was make-out friendly, but the locale wasn't. Once, maybe. But not since the understairs nook had become a kind of mythic reference point for students in the College of Liberal Arts. How was your sociology final? I asked her.
Okay. I doubt I aced it, but I know I passed it. It's good enough for me, especially since it's the last one.
She stretched, fingers touching the zigzag of the stairs above us and lifting her breast most entrancingly. I'm out of here in, she looked at her watch, exactly 1 hour and 10 minutes. You and Renee? I had no great liking for Wendy's roommate, but knew better than to say so. The one time I had, Wendy and I had a brief, bitter argument in which she accused me of trying to manage her life.
That is correct, sir. She'll drop me at my dad and stepmom's, and in 1 week we're official Filene's employees.
She made it sound as if the two of them had landed jobs as pages at the White House, but I held my peace on that, too. I had other concerns.
You're still coming up to Berwick on Saturday, right?
The plan was for her to arrive in the morning, spend the day, and stay over. She'd be in the guest bedroom, of course, but that was only a dozen steps down the hall. Given the fact that we might not see each other again until fall, I thought the possibility of it happening was very strong. Of course, little children believe in Santa Claus, and UNH freshmen sometimes went a whole semester believing that George B. Nako was a real professor teaching real English courses.
Absolutely.
She looked around, saw no one, and slipped a hand up my thigh. When it reached the crotch of my jeans, she tugged gently on what she found there. Come here, you. So I got my through-the-pants job after all. It was one of her better efforts, slow and rhythmic.